section on physical considerations in architecture. Big shift from the first third of the course, more on form in architecture. And last time we were talking about how buildings could learn from the land, from the landscape, from the character of the place where they were set, and how those physical characteristics of the place could be an inspiration for architectural form. And I ask you to think of a place that you might have experienced that might have some of these kinds of characteristics. And we got a lot of good Twitter card responses on that. So let me read a few. Someone says, in Costa Rica, I stayed in a treehouse-like structure with the Bribri tribe. All of the buildings were from surrounding trees. The structures were open air, which gave the building a way to connect with the rainforest around it. Someone else says, when I visited my dad's family in El Salvador, their homes reflected nature. The living rooms were open to allow for a tropical breeze. The kitchen was underground to regulate temperature, but a lot of cooking was also done outside to keep the home cool. Someone else says, a few hundred kilometers west of Guangzhou, China, there are these small stone houses that look like large versions of the smooth weathered stones from the nearby river. These houses convey the flow of the river and the flow of qi in Chinese culture. Someone else says, the house I once visited in a rural area of Korea was in harmony with the natural surroundings. The walls were layered so that during the summer, just sliding paper doors could be used to take in the breeze. In the winter, insulation could be added to accommodate the cold. Someone else says, the California Academy of Science in San Francisco sits in Golden Gate Park and is perfectly built as a part of the landscape of the park. The roof is even made of plants. Someone else says, the Denver International Airport is a perfect example of a building that was influenced by nature. It's an obvious recreation of the surrounding Rocky Mountains. The white pointed pyramids that make up the canopy of the airport are a reflection of the white tipped mountains. The interior also effectively reflects the surroundings. Walking into the main terminal, one feels inferior to the magnificent towering ceiling. Finally, I love this one. In The Hobbit, the houses that are built in the hills are a perfect example of being symbiotic with the environment. The whole house blends into the hill with a large circular door highlighting it to show where home is. So that's excellent sort of ingesting of what those messages might be in everyday surroundings around us. So today we're going to take some of those same issues, but we're going to jump scale a little bit. We're going to be talking today more about planning issues. And architecture and planning are very, very closely linked to each other. And in some ways you could just say that planning is a field about architecture writ large. So architecture might be at the sort of building scale, and we think of planning more at the city scale. But both of them are planning the physical environment. And in some ways that's true, but I think there are differences between them as well. So one big difference is that when you're doing planning, you tend to, you're not designing everything just like the way it's going to be. You're projecting a system or an order or a general quality, and it's probably not all going to be done exactly that way. And you know that going into it. So there have been, like, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of master plans for Paris, and none of them was completely implemented, but maybe 60% of that one was implemented. Then they did another one, and 80% of that one was implemented. And the collective of all of that is this very vibrant, very amazing city that's well planned, but never was any plan fulfilled perfectly. And I think that's just something you accept in planning. So that's a difference. In architecture, you tend to specify everything all the way through the building, and it often gets built that way. But in planning, you don't expect that kind of precision to happen. Another difference is that in architecture, we think of form a great deal, at least in current planning circles. They don't think of form so much. They're very, very concerned with physical considerations, and they're very, very concerned with human factors. But maybe form is not quite so significant as an issue in planning. So it's appropriate that we didn't talk so much about planning in the first one-third of the class, but we'll talk more about it, about the scale of planning, the scale of the city, as we talk about physical considerations and as we talk about human factors. And today we're really going to kind of concentrate a bit on planning. So I would say there are five different kinds of planning that we do. And we're not going to talk about all of those, but we'll focus in on a couple of them. One kind of planning is economic planning, so that there are definitely people in Austin, in any city, who are worrying about the economic future of that city, and they're thinking what businesses and what enterprises and what incomes might be gotten, and they're soliciting new businesses and they're recruiting. And then there are also people worried about the economic well-being of maybe less advantaged portions of the population, and they're worried about, you know, safety nets and meals on wheels and services, social services. All of those are a part of planning in the economic planning sense. Then there's a second kind of planning that we call land use planning. And in land use planning, we're saying certain functions go here and certain functions go there, certain functions go some other place. Maybe we don't want, a porno shop to go right next to an elementary school. Maybe that's not compatible, so we try to zone things so some compatible functions happen in relation to each other. That's called land use planning. A third kind of planning is what we call infrastructure planning, and this is often kind of invisible to us, but it's super, super important. But it's where there are water lines so that we can get, you know, good, clean, fresh water, where there are sanitary sewer lines where you can get rid of your waste and transport it and then have it processed and so on. Electrical service, these days data service, all of those systems that go through our cities, super, super important to the way we live these days. And there's somebody out there planning, what's our water service going to be? What's our storm sewer service going to be? What's our sanitary sewer service going to be? Where do we need new electrical lines? All of that is infrastructure planning. Then there's a fourth kind of planning that we call transportation planning. And that's saying where are roads, and where are freeways, and where are transit lines, and where are bicycle paths, and where are pedestrian routes, and where are hike and bike trails, and where are all of the different modes of transportation in the city? How do they link? How do they go to each other? That would even include airports, train stations, and then relate to regional kinds of transportation modes as well. Huge important part of planning is transportation planning. And then the fifth and final area is what we call environmental planning. And that's looking at how do we maintain ecological balance? How do we make sure that we're not creating terrible problems with water pollution or air pollution or flooding or other kinds of things that happen when we start screwing around with Mother Nature and are not careful about our environmental planning? So those are five general areas of planning, and all of them very parallel to issues we look at in a building, but now looking at them more at the scale of a city. And today we're going to focus in particular on environmental planning, and that is looking especially at issues of geography and topography and ecology, and how that shapes the physical environment of the city and all the way down to individual buildings within a city. So to kind of outline what the issues are here, I'm going to read a little story This is actually the introduction to a very important book that was written in the 1960s called Site Planning. And it basically is talking about how you deal with planning issues and how you apply them to a site for a building, a site for a city, a site for a neighborhood, whatever. And so this was right at the beginning, the introduction to that book. Here's the story. Once there was a hunter who spent his days tracking the wide prairies of North Dakota with his gun and dog, and sometimes with a small boy who would beg to trot along. On this particular morning, hunter and boy, far out on the prairie, sat watching intently a rise of ground ahead of them. It was pocked with gopher holes. From time to time, a small striped gopher would nervously whisk from the mouth of the den to the cover of matted prairie grass, soon to reappear with cheek food pouches bulging. Smart little outfits, the gophers, the hunter observed. I mean, the way they have things figured out. Whenever you come upon a gopher village, you can be sure it will be near a patch of grain where they can get their food, and close by a creek or slough where they can get their water. They'll not build their towns near willow clumps, for that's where the owls and the hawks will be roosting. And you'll not be finding them near stony ledges or a pile of rocks where their enemies, the snakes, will be hiding, ready to snatch them. When these wise little critters build their towns, they search out the southeast slope of a knoll that will catch the full sweep of the sun each day to keep their dens warm and cozy. The winter blizzards that pound out of the north and west leave a windward slope of their rises frozen solid, but will only drift loose powder snow on top of their homes. When they dig their dens, continued the hunter, do you know what they do? They slant the runways steeply down for 2 or 3 feet and then double back up near the surface again, where they level out a nice dry shelf. That's where they lie, close under the sod roots, out of the wind, warmed by the sun, near to their food and water, as far as they can get away from their enemies, and surrounded by all their little gopher friends. Yes, sir, they have it all planned out. Is our town built on the southeast slope? The small boy asked thoughtfully. No, said the hunter, our town slopes down to the north, in the teeth of the bitter winter winds and cold as a frosty gun barrel. He frowned. Even in summer, the breezes work against us. When we built the new flax mill, the only mill for 40 miles, where do you think we put it? We built it right smack on the only spot where every breeze in the summertime can catch the smoke from its stack and pour it across our houses and into our open windows. At least our town is near the river and the water, said the boy defensively. Yes, replied the hunter, but where near the river did we build our homes? On the low flat land inside the river bend, that's where. And each spring, when the snows melt on the prairie and the river swells, it floods out every cellar in town. Gophers would plan things better than that, the small boy decided. Yes, said the hunter, a gopher would be smarter. When the gophers plan their homes and towns, the boy philosophized, they seem to do it better than people do. Yes, mused the hunter, and so do most of the animals I know. Sometimes I wonder why. So obviously the point of all of this is that we kind of, as human beings, think, okay, dude, we're in control here, okay? We just go out and we just do it like we want to do it. And sometimes aren't thinking about all those environmental factors that are out there. And when we do that, it causes problems. And it creates issues and expense and discomfort. Whereas if one were to work a little more with the geography, the topography, the ecology, the climate, maybe some of those things wouldn't be so problematic. So that's really what we're going to be discussing today, is how do you work with all of those issues of geography, topography, and ecology. Last time it was more in an aesthetic sense. Today I'm talking very, very much in a technical, performative sense. How do we work with these forces of nature? So in Austin, we kind of pride ourselves in being a green city, being conscious of nature and ecology. Sometimes we do make really good moves in that regard. One example might be in the late 1990s, we had to relocate our airport. The airport that existed at that time was at Mueller. It was very close into the city, super convenient, but the city had grown up around it, and the runways were relatively short. They couldn't expand the runways because there were private property, houses, churches, schools in that neighborhood. Also, the sound of the airport was getting to be a real problem, all the planes landing and taking off. And because the runways were short, they had to really accelerate and rev up that engine fast so they could get off that runway. And so there were lawsuits that were brought against the city by homeowners and business owners in the area that said, you're exceeding the sound levels that are safe and healthy in a city. And the courts decided that the people around the airport were correct and that the airport was, in fact, encroaching on their property rights. And so the airport had two options. They could either soundproof everybody's home and all of the schools and all of the churches around them, or they could move the airport and put it somewhere else. So the decision was made, okay, we have to move the airport. Now, that's a big, big new investment on the part of the city. So they started thinking, well, where would we move it? And it's a good thing they thought environmentally about that. So let me tell you a few of the things they took into account. So, okay, what do you need for an airport? You need big, big, long, flat runways. And you have these huge airplanes, and they're coming down and banging down on that. So you need good structural capability to take those huge loads and transfer it into the runways and accommodate those airplanes. So there were some particular, really powerful physical factors that they had to take into consideration. Then they also could understand that Austin is a very complicated place geographically. We are at a split point in Austin. To the east is the coastal plains that go down to the Gulf of Mexico. The land is pretty flat all the way through there. The soil that's below the ground there is pretty consistently what we call Del Rio clay. Sometimes people call it black gumbo, but it's a clay soil that has very interesting structural properties. When this clay gets wet, it swells up, and when it dries out, it shrinks down, but it is expansive clay. So that's pretty much all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. There is this clay soil, fairly flat clay soil. Then right going through the middle of Austin is the Balcones Fault, and this was a geographical line where there was a shift at a certain point of the plates of the earth, and a complete geographical change. On the east is this coastal plain, and to the west is the hill country. And there the land is hilly, it's not flat. And there, if you scrape away the topsoil, you find limestone almost immediately, rock right there. So very strong, very solid, very predictable foundation condition. And in the middle of Austin, it really goes almost down Lamar Boulevard there, is where the Balcones Fault makes that shift. So if you're building an airport, obviously you'd like good flat land, like on the east side. But you also would like good solid soil or foundation material below. which is limestone, like the west side. And you certainly don't want to put an airport on hilly land like the west side. And you really don't want to put those runways on expansive clay like on the east side. So what to do? What to do? So they took overlays of exactly where the clays were and exactly where the slopes were. And they looked for those places where right between, where there might be a moment that had the limestone soil but have flat topography. And there were really two areas that had that characteristic. One was in Manor, just to the northeast of Austin, and another one is where Austin-Bergstrom Airport is, which is just to the southeast of Austin. And in those two little areas, they found an overlap of the characteristics they wanted. Now, in addition to that, they had to think about, where are the winds? And are there erratic winds, which are not good for flight? What are the weather conditions like? Are there areas where you have patches of fog routinely? That's not good for an airport. You want to have an area that has less foggy prevailing climate. So when they superimpose all those things on each other, they decided on the site of Austin-Bergstrom International Airport. And it's been a great location for an airport. But think how stupid it would have been to invest all that money and all that energy without doing this very careful environmental planning. That's the benefit of environmental planning. Now in Austin, it goes beyond just that kind of practical thing, like, okay, where do you locate an airport? But our wherewithal as a city is very dependent on environmental issues in Austin. So sometimes in Austin we talk about the three E's. The first E is environmental issues, like clean air, clean water, nature preserves, saving endangered species, controlling floodwater, all of those environmental features. Then the second E is experiential, that if in fact we manage the environment well, then we get this lifestyle where we can enjoy parks and recreation, and we can have clean air, and we can go swimming and boating in the clean water, and we can go hiking and biking and enjoy nature. And that creates a certain lifestyle and experience and recreational capabilities that we value. And then out of that positive experiential characteristic comes the third E, which is our economy. And in Austin, we don't have a great port like Houston. We're not at the hub of rail and air intersections like Dallas. The only reason for having a city the size of Austin here is just because people might like to live here. So if you don't have that lifestyle and experience that's positive, you screw it up, and then you don't have economic vitality in the city. So good environmental management leads to quality experience of life, leads to healthy economy. So it's important that we take these environmental issues very much to heart as we're planning the city of Austin. So today we're going to look at three examples primarily. And the first example is going to be a bad example. In this class, I don't usually show really bad examples. It's just painful. It's just not something I want to talk about. But today we're going to talk about a really bad example. And the sad thing is the really bad example is going to be the area of the state that I grew up in. My hometown, the little towns around it. And this was something that I experienced, you know, as a kid growing up and have watched develop for my whole life. And it's been a really sad thing to watch. So the area that I'm interested in here is I grew up in Friendswood, Texas. And it's the area of Friendswood, Pearland, Alvin, League City, Clear Lake City. So how many of you are from generally that area? Okay. There's always a fair number. So guys, just think about it. So where are you from?
League City.
League City. Where are you from?
A little bit ahead of League City.
Okay. League City, that's like 5 miles from where I grew up. Let's talk about the geography, topography, ecology, the environmental planning in that area. It's generally southeast of Houston, kind of between Houston and Galveston. So the land that was there to begin with had three salient characteristics. For one thing, absolutely flat as a pancake. Flat, flat, flat land. What we considered a hill was the freeway overpass. That's about the highest you ever got. Okay, flat land. Second characteristic is it is in that coastal area that has this expansive clay. So it has these very, very dense clay soils. And those soils, they not only have this expansive quality, but also water doesn't penetrate through them. Sandy soil absorbs water and sucks it down. But clay soils, not so much. The water doesn't penetrate so much. And then the third salient characteristic is it's an area with very heavy rainfall. Get 55 to 60 inches a year, but often the rainfall is in these torrential storms, especially during hurricane season. And you know what they're getting in South Carolina right now, like 22 inches of rain in 24 hours. That happens in this area not so infrequently, sometimes attached to a hurricane and sometimes just this huge rainstorm. So when you have those three characteristics, flat ground, not very absorptive soils, and heavy rainfall, it's a formula for flooding. You gotta worry about flooding. When you got flat land, the water doesn't know where to go. You know, if it's sloped, the water knows to go downhill. But, and you can look at rivers when you fly over and you look at a creek or a river around that area, they're like a snake. They wiggle like this. They don't know to go to the Gulf straight because it's so flat, there's no particular direction for the water to go. So that tends to make the water stay where it is, and that's a flood problem. And then the non-absorptive soils, the water's not getting soaked into the ground, so it stays above the ground. That's a flood problem. And then these huge rains that come, it just can't evacuate fast enough, so that's a flood problem. Three salient characteristics that add up to a real propensity to flood. Okay, so for centuries, people had been inhabiting that area, and it had not been a problem. So this is what happened. They did things that made sense in that ecology. So for instance, when I was a little kid, the primary use of the land in that area was for rice farming and cow pastures. So this was perfect for rice farming, because in rice farming, you want to flood the field to grow rice. Flat is perfect, you know, much better than what we saw in southern China where they had to make the flat out of mountains. This is perfect. The ground's already super flat. You don't want the absorptive soil. You want to flood the field, and you want it to stay, you know, wet. So the clay soils were good for that. Big rain, usually not a problem. So it was good for rice farming. But then the rice farming, if you farm rice over and over and over again, it depletes the nutrients in the soil. So frequently they would plant rice 1 year, and then for a couple of years, they'd turn the cows onto that pasture. And the cows have cloven hoofs. They've got two pieces to their hoof. And it tends to aerate that soil so that it pokes little holes in it, and that breaks up the soil. That's good for that hard clay soil. And also, they poop on it, and all that manure is good fertilizer, and that replenishes nutrients in the soil. So you run cattle on it for a couple of years, and then it's ready to be a rice farm again. So that's how the farmers had used this land for generations, and it worked perfectly. It was a good match of ecology and a way of human inhabitation of it. Then in 1962, LBJ was president, and LBJ made the decision to put the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. And not just in Houston, but really on this side of Houston. And it was located in sort of Webster, now it's called Clear Lake City. That was a new town built up for the Manned Spacecraft Center. But in 1962, suddenly tons of people were coming in, and there was a lot of development that was going to happen in the area. And all these Yankees came in, so all us hicks that had been living there all the time, you know, people from New York and Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, places we'd barely heard of, invaded our little hick town. At that point, when I was a kid, the population of Friendswood was 900. Now the population of Friendswood's 35,000. So it was a little hick town, a little agricultural town, and then all these people came in from outside. So a huge propensity to develop the area. Okay, so three things happened that were bad in the development of that area. And they were kind of dumb, and they did not take into account the environmental issues in that region. So one thing they did was they put down all this impervious cover. So impervious cover, that's spelled I-M-P-E-R-V-I-O-U-S, impervious cover. That means that water can't go through. You put something on the top of the soil that water can't go through. So when you put asphalt roads down, that's impervious cover. When you put a slab on grade, concrete to build your house or your shopping center, that's impervious cover. Anything that keeps the water from going into the soil, that's impervious cover. So as they developed this area around the Manned Spacecraft Center, they built lots and lots of roads. They built lots of shopping centers with huge parking lots. They built lots of houses with slab on grade. Previous to this, in that area, the houses weren't built with a slab on the ground. They were built up on stilts. So the house I lived in until I was 5 years old, that was up on stilts. But then by the time it got to be when NASA came in, then it was more, it seemed like, you know, better. It was better quality construction to just put the slab on the ground. So they started doing slab on grade. And they did that all over after NASA came in. So all of this is tons and tons and tons of impervious cover. And in the general region, it was like it turned from maybe 1% impervious cover to 60% impervious cover. The combination of all the roads and all the parking lots and all the slab on grade and shopping centers and houses and everything, about 60% impervious cover in many areas. Okay, that was one problem. A second problem is that they put in storm sewer systems. Now, storm sewer is not to be confused with sanitary sewer. Sanitary sewer is what you flush down from your commode. That's sanitary sewer. What we're talking about here is what happens to storm water when it rains. And you know, when you go along the streets in Austin and you see at the corner a big gutter, a big opening there, and the water all goes down the curbs and slides into the gutter there, and it's just mysterious what happens. Well, what happens is it goes into a storm sewer system, and there'll be a concrete pipe about that big right underneath that street, and then that one will go for a while, and it'll flow into a concrete pipe about that big, and then it'll flow into a concrete pipe about that big, and then it'll go into Town Lake, or it'll go into a creek, or it'll go into something like that. But generally, this is how we do things in cities. We have curbs and gutters and storm sewers that take the water away. Now, in this particular region, before NASA came in, we didn't have curbs and gutters and storm sewers. We were hicks. So what we had in front of our houses was a ditch. And it even sounds crappy, doesn't it? A ditch. You know, so everybody had one. In front of their house, you had your front lawn, then you had a ditch, and then you had the road. And your driveway would have a culvert that would go over the ditch. And when it rained really big, we'd all, you know, roll up our pants legs and we'd go out there and, you know, we didn't have a swimming pool, but man, the ditch was great, you know, and there were crawdads and you'd poke sticks down the hole and get the crawdads to come out. I mean, it was like huge recreational thing, these ditches. It was a real pain in the ass when you had to mow the lawn because it wasn't flat. You had to go down the ditch, back up the ditch, you know. So, but we had ditches. Everybody had ditches. Now, that was the drainage system. So all the streets and the lawns, they'd flow the water into the ditch, and then the ditch would carry it to a gully, and the gully would carry it to a bayou, and the bayou would carry it to the creek, and the creek would take it to Clear Lake, which was the lake around there, and the Clear Lake went out into the Gulf of Mexico. So that's how the water got taken away. And the good thing about the ditches was they could be grossly oversized. So you just made them by taking a maintainer and a blade and digging out the soil and pushing on either side. Pretty cheap to do it. And they were grossly overscaled. So when there was a huge rain, they might fill up. But most of the time, they didn't even come close to filling up. And then the other advantage of them was there was some absorption along the way. Okay, it was clay soil, it wasn't super absorptive, but some water would be absorbed along the way. When you put in storm sewers, it's different. Now you're taking a big concrete pipe and you're putting it under the ground, but it's a finite size. Only so much water can go in that pipe. So if things change over time, that pipe might be inadequate to carry the water, and then the water backs up on the other side. They're engineered to be just the right size. But if circumstances change, the calculations are wrong, and they're not the right size. So we went from ditches, which were hugely flexible, to curbs and gutters and storm sewers, which had finite capabilities. And once that drop of water goes in that storm sewer, it's not absorbed anywhere. It just goes to the other end, and it's got to be taken care of. So we went from ditches to storm sewers, and that created a problem, as we'll talk about. Okay, then the third thing. So we had impervious cover, we had storm sewers, and the third thing is we had subsidence, S-U-B-S-I-D-E-N-C-E, subsidence. Now, all of this area in the Gulf Coast has a very high water table. And the water table is pretty good water. So when I was a kid, we had a well and we had a pump. So all you had to do was just poke a hole and go down about 40 feet, and there was the water table, and it was good, clean, clear water. So in our old house, all we had was a well and a pump. And we had a pump house out in the yard, and that supplied all the water. And everybody did that. They just poked a hole, had a well, and got their water out of the groundwater. Well, then at a certain point, rather than have everybody do that individually, the city came in, and they poked a big hole down to the water table. And then they pumped all that water out and put it in the big old water tower, you know, built a water tower in our town. We never had a water tower. Now we're getting to be a town. We had a water tower. And they stored it all there, and then it got sent to everybody's house. But the problem is when you pump the water out from under the ground, although this doesn't sound intuitively exactly right, the water is holding the ground up. It's the water that has mass and that the ground is sitting on. So when you start pumping it out, it starts reducing that water table and it makes the ground sink or subside. So that's creating subsidence. So at the same time, a little way away from there was the Hastings oil field, and they were also pumping fluids from below the ground. They were pumping oil. and that also was creating less bulk below the ground, and it was causing subsidence. So in a period of about 20 years, the ground fell 10 feet. 10 feet, this is like the whole region, it's all going down 10 feet. It already wasn't much above sea level, maybe 30 feet above sea level. And now it's gone down to 20 feet above sea level. So the whole thing was subsiding. And that, if you think about that, 20 feet over 10 years, that's like it's like 2 feet a year. That's like a half an inch a month. It's like really pretty severe subsidence. And that was happening in that general region. And some places more than other places. Okay, so we got three problems. Man-made problems. We did this. Impervious cover, storm sewers, and subsidence. So NASA comes in 1962. In 1979, so just 17 years later, there were two huge floods in this area. And one of them came in August, and one of them came in September. These weren't even hurricanes. They were just, there was a huge rainstorm where 30 inches fell in 24 hours. And it flooded the hell out of everything in this area. I mean, definitely in Friendswood. Pretty much everybody got affected. It wasn't just spotty. And my parents' house, which had been there for, 20 years, was and had never been even near a flood. There were 3 feet of water in the entire house. And I don't know if any of you have ever been through a flood, but holy moly, it's horrible, horrible, nasty thing. It ruins everything. It's not like it just gets wet. It gets soaked, and all your furniture falls apart after it's been flooded. All the sheetrock is unsalvageable. You just have to take it out. All the carpets are completely ruined. Any wood floors, they all start warping and twisting. The studs in your wall absorb the water, and they start warping and twisting. It's just disastrous. It cost tons of money to fix it, and it also is just hugely disruptive to your life. Everything smells horrible after a flood. Everything has been just penetrated by this muddy, mucky, ugly, dirty water. And when it's not just your house, it's all of your neighbors. It's all of your town. Everybody is devastated by this. It just puts a complete depression and pall over the whole area. It was horrible. By then, I was out of the house, but I went down and helped my parents recover from the flood. And, the entire city, it was terrible. And most people did not have insurance, because this had not been a flood-prone area. So people didn't think they needed insurance. And it had not been a flood-prone area. It became a flood-prone area because we made it a flood-prone area. We did things that created flood problems. And so in 1979, one flood in August, people barely kind of got a little recovered, and wham, a second flood in September. And property values just plummeted. You had a house that was worth $200,000. Now you couldn't unload it for anything. No one would buy it. You don't have the money. You don't have insurance to repair it. I mean, this is horrible, horrible problem that's been created. Okay, that was in 1979. Then people did. They thought, okay, well, that was like an unusual flood event. 30 inches of rain in 24 hours. That hardly ever happens. That was just a fluke. So they put their house back together. They reinvested their money. My parents, fortunately, they had a couple of rent houses in a ways away. And so one of them happened to be vacant. They could move into the rent house. And so they had a place to stay. And then they had plenty of money. So they put the money back in. We had a big, nice house. They completely redid the house, you know, new flooring, new walls, new furniture, everything redone. Of course, all your photographs are ruined. Those are just gone forever. All the books, they were ruined. They were gone forever. An heirloom organ that the family had, it was gone forever. So, you know, some things you couldn't replace, but they kind of recovered. And then, God damn it, in 1983, Hurricane Alicia comes through there. And it happens all over again. And everything's flooded. Everybody's house is flooded again. Just about the time they recovered and got back on their feet. Just about the time house prices had some value, some reality, whack. And they were in the tank again. Now, since then, you know, they've tried to do a number of different things. They dredge out the creeks a little bit, but when you dredge out a creek, and that lets the water flow more quickly through that creek, but then they also found out that when they dredged them out, then they destroyed all the root systems and everything that was holding the soil in place, so then all the soil would just slump down into the creek again, so you'd have to come back and dredge it out and come back and dredge it out. And all those beautiful trees that were there, they all died, and the creeks weren't beautiful anymore. And it was a horrible, horrible problem. So when NASA first came in my little town in Friendswood, they started to have new subdivisions. We didn't even know what subdivisions were, but you know, now there were going to be, people came in and they developed this land for a subdivision. And the first one that went in Friendswood was developed by the richest family in town, which was the Browns. And they had this big piece of land that was on the creek, and they created a subdivision called Imperial Estates. Okay, you got this? This is a hick town, okay? And we have Imperial Estates. Now, I'm not sure what empire this was a part of, but we had Imperial Estates. And so all these Yankees coming into NASA, they move into Imperial Estates. And we had Deke Slayton, who was one of the seven original astronauts. He lived in Imperial Estates. And Chris Kraft, who was the voice of NASA, he was on all the TV shows and all of that. He was the spokesperson for NASA. He lived in Imperial Estates. And all these badass Yankees came in and built their big, fancy houses in Imperial Estates on the creek, because the trees were big and it had all this Spanish moss. They loved the Spanish moss. And it was so scenic. And so they built all their houses in Imperial Estates. Well, when that first flood came through in 1979, Imperial Estates got whacked. I mean, it was right there on the creek, flooded. And then in 1983 in Alicia, again, Imperial Estates got whacked, flooded. Right now, there is no Imperial Estates. They tore down all of those houses. The federal government bought the houses back from people because they wouldn't give them insurance on it anymore, because they didn't want to pay for having to rebuild it every time there was a flood. It was a stupid place to put big houses, and it just caused wretched devastation, and now it's just vacant land again, like it used to be. What was Imperial Estates is now just vacant land because it's in the floodplain. So this is a sad story, and it continues. In 2008, Hurricane Ike came through that area. It didn't hit head-on there, but it caused flooding again, substantial flooding in that whole area. It's not solved. It's just an accident kind of waiting for the next storm to happen. And every time it happens, it creates horrible devastation. My family can remember in 1961, before any of this started, when Hurricane Carla came through. Hurricane Carla was a much, much worse storm than Hurricane Ike. But when Hurricane Carla came through, you know, I remember that, and basically all the lights went out for about a week. And that meant that our freezer didn't work anymore. And so we took all the meat out of the freezer and we just had continuous barbecue all week. And we invited all the neighbors over. My recollection of Hurricane Carla was the best party I had ever gone to. Continuous barbecue for a whole week and ate up all that meat that was in the freezer. But nobody's house got flooded. Nobody's house got flooded. They built, all the houses had been built not on the creek. Our house wasn't on the creek. It was half a mile from the creek because it was in a sensible spot. And we didn't have all those aggravating factors of subsidence and impervious cover and storm sewers. And it was, you know, trees got knocked down. It was a big storm, but it didn't devastate the area. In 1983, in Alicia, that storm was much smaller than Carla, but it totally devastated the area. And in 2008, that storm, Ike, was much smaller than Carla, and it again totally devastated the area. Now, we sometimes talk of these as natural disasters, and right now in South Carolina, they're suffering a natural disaster. But probably a substantial part of that disaster, as in the case of this area around Houston, is a man-made disaster. It's because we're not following good principles of environmental planning. Okay, so that's the bad news. Now we're going to look at a couple of better examples, good examples. And the first of these is also in the sort of greater Houston area. And this is at the Woodlands. Now the Woodlands, how many people live in the Woodlands or Kingswood or someplace around there? Okay, there's always a few there too. Now, when I'm talking about the Woodlands today, I'm talking about the first phase of the Woodlands. That there have been many other phases of the Woodlands that are not environmentally planned like this. And all the other developments around there, Kingswood, I think, across the freeway, not very well environmentally planned. But the first phase of the Woodlands was very well planned environmentally. So it was a couple named George and Cynthia Mitchell who were the owners of this land. George Mitchell made a ton of money in the oil business, and he decided he was going to build a new town outside of Houston. So he bought this big piece of land, and he was an environmentalist. And he said, there's a good way to plan this such that we will not have environmental problems. So he hired a land planner named Ian McCarg. He taught at University of Pennsylvania. He wrote a really important book called Design with Nature, where he talks about how you design cities that are in concert with natural forces. And so he came down and was the land planner for the Woodlands first phase. And he did three things, actually four things, that make an incredible amount of sense. Now, this area is not so different from the area around Friendswood and Pearland and Alvin. It's a little bit sandier soil. It's a little more absorptive soil. And you get pine trees there, whereas you don't get many pine trees southeast of Houston. But it's flat as a pancake, and it's, of course, has the same heavy rain cycles as the area we've just been talking about. So there are four things he does here. Number one thing is it's flat, but nothing's perfectly flat. There's some areas that are a little higher and some areas that are a little bit lower. So in the areas that were a little bit lower, they did no development. They just left it land. So where there it's a little bit lower, no development. And then where it's a little bit higher, that's where you build the houses and the office buildings and the retail parks and so on. So that's the first principle. You don't build on the lowest land. You only build on the higher land. Then the second thing he did was to create detention ponds like that. So on that lower land, he would hollow it out a little lower than that. And the idea is that when a flood would come, it would go to that lower land, and there would be the capacity for lots of water to just stay there for a while. So it goes off of the higher land, it stays there, It doesn't flood everything else. It just sits in that detention pond and then can slowly be released over weeks even, so that it doesn't create flooding problems downstream. So the second big idea was these detention ponds. And then those areas that were not built on and that had the detention ponds, those would become recreation areas. It'd become a little lake. It would be a place for parks. It would be a place for hike and bike trails. It would be a benefit to the neighborhood, environmentally, certainly, but also just as a recreational use. Okay, so we can see that some of those areas that were just preserved, a little bit lower. You can put a swimming pool in there. Who the hell cares if the swimming pool floods? No big deal. You know, you put those things that make sense there. You can make sculpture parks there. You can, you know, do hike and bike trails, playing fields. You know, all of those things can go in that area. And here's one of those detention ponds. So this is a retail area, and they're looking out to this scenic pond. Little ducks on there going, quack, 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 quack. You know, you're thinking, oh, they did this just to be pretty and to make these nice duckies here. No, it's a detention pond. It's a technical device for preventing flooding. So there's a little waterfall here that's really nice. This little kid thinks he's going to catch a fish. Good luck, Joe. But, you know, so it's recreational. But what happens is when there's a big rain, you can see that the water can come up like that. And it's huge, so there's an enormous capacity of water that can be stored there and not be flooding people's houses, but is being detained there and slowly released downstream. What a brilliant device. And it looks like it's just beautiful and scenic, but in fact, it's addressing these issues of physical considerations. Okay, don't build on the low ground. Create detention ponds. A third thing is minimize impervious cover. So here's hardscape in the kind of original urban center of the Woodlands Phase 1. And it's all decking so that the water can go in the little slits between the wood slats there. And it can be absorbed into the ground and you don't have to dispose of the water. And wherever they could, they used pervious cover. They used something hardscape that would allow the water to go through it. And then they also minimized all of the impervious cover they put down. So normally in a suburban area like this, you would have 32-foot wide streets. In Friendswood, it was a requirement. The minimum street width you could have in a subdivision was 32 feet wide. Now that's freaking ridiculous, because two cars can pass each other comfortably in 22 feet. You make it 32 feet wide, so just in case everybody has a Christmas party all at once, there's plenty of parking on both sides of the street, which never happens. I mean, most of you know, neighborhoods you grew up in, these huge, wide, concrete streets, and room for parking on both sides. Are there ever cars parked there? Once in a blue moon. But all the rest of the time, it's impervious cover. So in the Woodlands, they made 22-foot wide streets instead of 32 feet wide. And then they made little parking areas periodically, but much more efficient minimizing of impervious cover. Then the fourth thing they did was they did not have storm sewers. The streets don't have any curbs and gutters. They just flow off into the ground on either side. The drainage system is in the back of the houses, and it's in ground swales. So ground swales is a much nicer way of saying ditch. Basically, they hollow out an area behind the house where all of the water can flow away, but it's that oversized swale or drainage way behind the house. So they do four things. They don't build on the low ground. They make detention ponds. They reduce impervious cover, and they have ground swales instead of storm sewers. And the result is that in phase one of the Woodlands, for a good 25 years, there was no flooding. There was plenty of flooding in all the areas around it, but there was no flooding there. Now, it actually turns out that now, because they have not planned the areas around it well, they send flood water into the Woodlands One, and even it gets flooded sometimes now. But this was a super successful way of dealing with the same problems that were faced in Friendswood and Pearland in that area. Now, I will say that the buildings in the Woodlands Phase One were ugly as shit. I mean, they were awful. I'm not gonna make any claims to beautiful buildings. They were just the same thing you see everywhere. But man, the environmental planning, it was really, really quite good. Okay, third example. This one is really good. Good in pretty much every regard. But this was a very valuable, very prized piece of land. This was 5,000 acres on the northern shore of the Pacific Ocean, just north of San Francisco, maybe 60 miles north of San Francisco. And it's an area called Sea Ranch. We looked at the condominiums at Sea Ranch last time. This is the whole region around that. And that 5,000 acres was bought by a developer from Hawaii. It was incredibly scenic, beautiful land. And he was developing it for mostly people who had retired in San Francisco and moved up to be in this beautiful, beautiful coastline environment. Now, the original ecology of this area was a redwood forest. And there was redwood forest that went right up to the ocean. But about, 120 years ago, they had cut down the redwoods all the way through here for logging, and they had harvested them for wood. And then they let the redwoods regrow away from the coast, but along the coastline, they didn't let the redwoods regrow, and they used it for pasture land for cows. So there's about an 80-year history of this being used as pasture land for cows. And I mentioned last time there are huge winds in this area coming off the ocean. And so the poor cows, they'd be out there grazing in the field, and a big old gust of wind would go and knock them on their ass. And so the ranchers had to figure out some way to protect the cows. So they built these big hedgerows, and they ran perpendicular to the ocean. And this is inside one of those hedgerows. So they're Monterey cypresses, this dense tree, and they'd been two of them parallel to each other, and then the cattle could get in here and shelter themselves from the heavy winds. So there were these hedgerows that ran perpendicular to the ocean, and in between were grasslands for the cows. So then this developer comes along. He hires this fantastic team of planners. The main planner was Lawrence Halperin, a fantastic environmental planner. And he worked with other architects like Moreland and Turnbull Whitaker, who did the condominiums we looked at last time, Joseph Escherich, other really good architects that participated here. So this is the 5,000 acres. And you can see the way they developed it. They would build the houses up against the hedgerows. So you see these perpendicular lines, everything moving right, nestling the houses against the hedgerows, using the hedgerows as a buffer for the wind and putting the houses nestled in against them, and then leaving the meadows in between quite open. So that's one thing they did, was use the ecology that had been put there, the Monterey cypresses, as a benefit. And then the other thing they did was they clustered all of the houses. So instead of just putting plop, 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 you know, suburban houses all on little lots, and then you'd have had to take roads all over and cul-de-sacs and all that impervious cover that goes with this whole road system. Instead, there's a highway that runs along here, and they just took little bitty umbilicals off that highway and made a little, you know, area to park, and then they clustered around there and they clustered around here. And that allowed them to leave the rest of that area completely natural. The grasslands natural, the ecology of the area pretty much what it was when they found it. And this is what that looks like. We saw the condominium there last time. This is that hedgerow that the condominium is built into.
There you see the condominium up against the hedgerow there, condominium into the hedgerow. All of these hedgerows kind of running down perpendicular to the ocean. This is another development different from the condominium. This is a bunch of houses done by Joseph Eschrich, a different architect, but they're all nestled up against the hedgerow there. And you can even see the wind as it's blown those trees, and you see the shape that the wind made the tree into. Well, they made that same shape in the roof of the house so that it diverts that prevailing wind and gives you a shadow area back here which is protected from the wind and where you can be outside and enjoy the view and the natural environment. So the building is built into the vegetation and built very much to deal with the wind that's happening there. So the building and the landscape technically become one, not just visually become one, but in a performative way, the building is working with the landscape. And that happens all over in Sea Ridge. The place is completely developed now. I've gone in the summer, rented one of these houses for a week or two. Fantastic place to go on a vacation. Stunningly beautiful landscape. Completely built out, but it didn't screw up the landscape. It still looks beautiful and natural because the buildings have been placed in such a way as to not overwhelm the nature, but to work very well with it. And they left all those native grasses so that they stabilize the soil in this windy area. If you disrupt the root system in those soil, then you have huge soil erosion. Everything was done very carefully to minimize any of that disruption of that vegetation and to keep the grasses there and the soil in its place. Some really cool houses have been built there. This is one where it's actually lets the slope of the ground comes and becomes the roof of the house, and it's got a sod roof, and the house is just tucked under the ground. This one is another one by Charles Moore, the Moore of that, Moore Linden Turnbull Whitaker, who did the condominiums, and it's just nestled kind of below the ground a little bit. That idea of protecting in the courtyard, that's used in many of the houses here. There's some public swimming pools, and they're using, again, natural means to provide comfort here. So they've got earth berms up on either side to protect the wind, so you're there in your bathing suit, dripping wet, freezing cold if you're in the wind, but if you get out of the wind, it's actually quite nice to lie in the sun. But there it is, protected on three sides by the earth berms, and on the fourth side by the bathhouse itself, using these topographical devices to protect the tennis courts or protect the swimming pools and to make them environmentally appropriate in this place. Now, the bottom line here is that, you know, it actually can make beautiful, beautiful places. I think the architecture of Sea Ranch, very simpatico with the environment, and actually really pleasant, really nice houses and places to live, but built very much in concert with these issues of geography, topography, and ecology. So for your Twitter card question, I want you to think of, you've got two options. Think of an instance where, and I'm not just thinking aesthetically, I'm thinking technologically, where the building really worked in an environmental sense. It really worked with the land slope or the water issues or the whatever, but it worked well environmentally. Or think of an example where it screwed up. Some place, I don't know,